Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response to Midday for the second day of Kislev. Today we're going to see a Tzitz Eliezer. It's Chilek Tet Vav Simon Ayin, part 15, response number 70. And it's going to be on what's something that in modern philosophy is called the trolley problem. So the trolley problem, we'll see it in here, but it has to do with what choices we're allowed to make in terms of saving some lives, if that means we're going to have to hurt other lives, in which ways and how it would work. So we'll get into that. But first, let's make sure to thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Brownwitz, David Hachhauser, for putting the shiurim online and making them available to you. So this is the question that he poses, this question. The trolley problem is you're standing over a trolley, like you're standing over a bridge, and there's a trolley that's out of control, you know, by accident, it's out of control, and it's going to hit and kill, let's say, five people. But you can either flip a switch, or the other possibility is throw a person in its way, and however that will work. So flipping a switch is one possibility, and then in the problem, but if you flip the switch, it'll go to a different track, and it'll kill only one person. So the question becomes, are you allowed to arrange that one person being killed to have the greater benefit of saving the five people? Or you throw the person over, are you allowed to throw that person into the path of a train, and that will therefore stop? And I think in the problem, you yourself couldn't jump in front of the train because you're not big enough. Whatever the story is, the way that Tzitz Eliezer presents the problem is, im chayav o rashay adam likanes l'safek sakana kedil hatzil chaveram mivadai sakana. The entry question is, is a Jew required to put themselves into a possible situation of danger to save their fellow Jew from a certain situation of danger? This comes up in lots and lots of cases. He doesn't give the exact example, but a simple example comes to mind as I'm giving the shiur is, am I required to donate a kidney, which has some level of danger to it, but only a suffix sakana? It's not like a dangerous thing, but it has a suffix sakana. In order to save somebody from a definite problem of death would be an example of it. Or another example would be somebody's drowning and I'm an okay swimmer, I'm a pretty good swimmer. Am I required to jump in where I might be pulled away by the riptide or whatever it is that's causing them to be having problems in order to save them? Second question is, im rasha'im la'asot leman hatzalat rabim, in something that will cause the death of an individual. I'm going to save many people from death, but it's going to cause the death of an individual. So that's from the second of Kislev Tufshin Mem Gimel of, pretty sure it's still 1982. And he gave this talk as part of a Hadron L'Siyuma D'Shas. There was a Siyuma Shas that was going on. He was participating. He was giving a talk, and he had, this is the Chilek HaHalacha. You would very often, in these kinds of settings, you'll give a halachic part of a discourse, and then a more hashkafic, agadic part of a discourse. This is the halachic part of the discourse. So it sounds like sort of fuzzy problems. These are actual halachic issues. And it comes up because in the last Gemara in Nida, towards the very end of Nida, the last daf of Nida, daf Samach Aleph Amid Aleph, in Nida is the last tractate of the Babylonian Talmud, there's the following story is told. There were certain people who the government, the non-Jewish government, was intending to kill because the rumor had spread, there was word that this group of people had killed somebody. So they come to Rabbi Tarfon. They don't say whether they killed the person or not. They come to Rabbi Tarfon and they say, what should we do? And he says to them, what should I do? If I hide you, if I don't hide you, they're going to find you and you're going to get killed. If I hide you, problem is, he says, Rabbi Tarfon, that the tradition is, while you're not allowed to believe Lashon Hara, you're not allowed to believe negative rumors about somebody else, you are required lemechash. You are required to worry they might be true, meaning you're not supposed to spread Lashon Hara. But let's say, however it happens, some Lashon Hara gets out there, some negative information about a person gets out there that's not completely verified. If it's verified, I certainly have to worry about it. Let's say it's not verified. Even though it's not verified, I do have the right to say, well, I've heard this rumor and it might be true. Then I'm not allowed to believe that it is true. So however I would act if I'm certain it's true, I'm not allowed to do that. But I am allowed, says Rabbi Tarfon, to worry that it's true. So if I'm worrying that it's true, then I'm going to put my... Well, we'll talk about the ramifications of that in a second. That's the way the story is in the Gemara. And therefore, he says to them, Zila aton tamaru nafshaiku. So you go hide. You go hide yourselves. That's the way the story goes. And Rashi explains that when it says mechash, that I'm allowed to worry about it, or I'm required to worry about it, he says, v'shem harakta, maybe you did kill the guy, and therefore I'm not allowed to save you. So in Rashi's version, the worry is, I have to take into account that they might be murderers, and therefore I have to act as if they might be murderers. Now, might be murderers means I don't turn them over to the government. If they were actual murderers, I'd turn them over. Might be murderers means I have to worry. Tosfos quotes a she'iltot that takes a different view. That's Shema Harakdem, maybe you did kill, and if I hide you, then I'm going to be putting myself at risk in terms of the government, because I'll be aiding and abetting people who were murderers. Now that's a very different view, because that seems to assume that if he knew they were murderers, he still wouldn't have given them up. Because his only point here is maybe you did it, and I'm not willing to put myself in danger for you. So in this Sfarim, Agudat Ezov and Shut Yad Eliyahu, says the Tzitz Eliezer, they drew the lesson from this story, especially according to the Shiltot, that a person is not obligated to put himself in danger in a possible danger situation to save his friend from a Vaday situation. Because they were in a definite situation of danger. And they say, these Achronim said, and it's not real danger for Ritafer, because Ritafer, the government caught him, because it said, I didn't know that they killed anybody. I thought, I didn't know that, and that's why I hid them. So, and therefore he wouldn't get punished. So that they were taking it that there's no real actual danger for Bitarfon here, and therefore they understood that there's no obligation for you to put yourself into any kind of a worry. Right? It's only a suffix I kind of take. It's only a doubtful worry, a danger, because he could argue he didn't know, and that's not a real danger. So if he's putting himself in real danger, that would be a question. But since it's not real danger, it's only possible danger, therefore they say it must be that he's not required to. The Nitziv, however, in Ha'amek She'alah, in his commentary on the She'iltot, takes the exact opposite view from the exact same She'iltot. So that's it's a topic that sort of is becoming an underlying subtext for me of all these Tshuvot, of the question of what do we do about the fact that the different great rabbis who know around the same amount and have the same acquaintance with all the sources come to diametrically opposed conclusions. So we have this tradition for sure of Elu Elu Devaru Kim Chaim. Everybody's got the word of God, and it's all holy and it's all good. But there's an intellectual challenge here of what it means and how we react to the fact that people of goodwill and good intellect and great knowledge come to metrically opposed conclusions. I think there is a thought there to be had that we have not yet had about how we handle that at a meta level. What do we think about that, and how does that shape our understanding of the value of dispute and our understanding of how we react to dispute? But that's not our topic today. Our topic today is the Nativ comes up with the opposite, comes to the opposite conclusion from the same Shiltot. That in general, there would be an obligation to put oneself in a situation of doubtful danger, of possible danger, to save a fellow Jew from certain danger, because according to the manuscript version, meaning the reading of the Shiltot and the Gemara, the words of the Gemara, Rabbi Tarfon says to these guys, maybe you did kill them. And if you did kill them is when he's not willing to put himself out for them. But if it had been clear to Rabbi Tarfon that they didn't kill them, even though the government might be assuming that they did, and therefore the government might be planning to chase them down, punish them, and kill them. That's why they're in definite danger of death. They're in definite danger. That's because the government's believing a false report. But if Rabbi Tarfon became convinced that it was false, it sounds like from the story that he would have done everything he could to help them, even though he would have been putting himself into a situation of danger. His comment to them is, since I'm not sure you didn't do it, I have the halachic right to think you might have done it, I'm not sure that I need to put myself in danger for you. That's the way the Nitziv read the story. Now, the Tzitzel comes up with a third option. He says he, in another place, we're not going to get into it because it's not here, but he, in another place, had written at length to say that the Sugya doesn't prove anything because it depends on Rashi's understanding, because it depends on commentary, right? It depends on how you understand the story. Rashi had a slightly different understanding of the story than the Tosfot, and there are different manuscript versions of the words of the Gemara, and those affect it. So you have just a blurry situation. So you have no way of determining, of this story being determinative, of being, I think the word in English is probative, of deciding for us what the halacha is. If you have the words reading this way, and you understand those words this way, then you'll come to this conclusion. If you have them another way, you come to another conclusion. And that would therefore mean, in our Elu Ve'elu mode, that would mean that halachically, as far as this story goes, we have equal evidence on both sides of whether or not one is required to put oneself into a situation of possible danger in order to save a fellow Jew from certain danger. And then he adds, but the truth is that he thinks that the Nitziv's claim might be a little bit weaker, because it could be that we would say Hatzolat Rabi Mishani, that it's different also in terms of saving many people. The story of the Bitarfin was there were a group of people who were in danger, because it says the B'nai Galila, right, which sounds like few. And the Yavshel Shlomo and the Magen Avraham agree that this is a group there. So a Yachid, an individual, might be required or might need to put himself into a possible doubtful danger in to help a tzibor, to help a community. Meaning it could be that, well, however we rule on the question of, if it's just me and you, I, one of us is in certain danger, the other one may or may not have a responsibility to put themselves in a possible danger. But what if it's a person, individual, and a community, and if the individual puts himself or herself in possible danger, they have a good chance of saving a whole community, a whole group from definite danger. So there seems more room to say that that's a requirement. And the source that he's referring to when he talks about the Yom Shel Shlomo, the Magen Avraham, is there's a Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Taanit. So the laws of Taanit, the laws of fasting, we today think about them as certain ritual days in commemoration of the Beit HaMikdash, but the actual laws of fasting focus much more on times of trouble that affect the Jewish people, affect communities of the Jewish people. And so one of those could be like a plague. Thank God today plagues are much, much more rare and much more, and are usually more easily contained. But plague used to be a terrible, terrible danger to a community, and large percentages of people would die. I had always thought, for example, of the Black Death in 1348, it was a terrible plague, and I think it killed a third of Europe or maybe more. And I always thought that it came that time, and then it went away. But the truth is, every 10 or 15 years, it was like based on the hibernation and gestation cycles of certain kinds of rats, but every 10 or 15 years, the plague would come back for the next 400 years in Europe. I didn't learn this till much, you know, till I was in graduate school, and I happened to read a book about it. Came back periodically, and it just killed a certain number of people. The only reason why you don't hear about it so much is because it wasn't so surprising. They knew what it was. It was a plague. And that's actually, I think Sir Isaac Newton made a lot of his discoveries when he was out of London because a plague had hit London, and he used to go to the countryside because it was considered to be safer in the fresh air. And it may have been because there were fewer people around, but that's what he did. And that's when he made lots of his discoveries, like of gravity and other, and maybe the calculus too. Anyway, so plague was a big deal. That's all I'm trying to say. And they eventually, just because I think it's such an interesting fact, the only way they conquered plague, the plague of that plague, they didn't find a cure for it. The way they conquered plague was by quarantining, by strict quarantining. And strict quarantining of the plague meant it didn't spread and it died. The same way that was really what happened with things like, in our times, Ebola. As if you can impose a quick and strict quarantine, you can much more easily, you don't solve the plague, you just stop that outbreak and then you save lives. Anyway, so the Shulchan Aruch passes, the Hilchos Taanis. If somebody separates themselves from the community, they're not going to see the comfort of the community, but if they, so that's talking about general times of trouble of the community. Community's in a time of trouble, I say, I'm going away. The classic example is the beginning of the Book of Ruth, when Mahlon and Kilion and Elimelech and their family leave the famine, that scene, leaving every circle of the famine, that scene is an example of abandoning the Jewish people and abandoning the community in their time of trouble. But if you stay and you are and you partake of the distress with them, then you merit being part of the comfort. The Magen Avraham there says, Operation Tibor. That's if you have some ability to contribute somehow to the salvation of the community with your body, with your money. You have some resources that will help. But if you're not helping in any way and you can escape the time of trouble, then you should. So an example would be a plague or if a war is coming. So in the case of a war, you'd probably say that everybody who helps can help. But let's suppose that somebody is so infirm that they're not going to be able to be part of the war effort at all, and a war is coming, or a siege is coming, if they can get away, then get away. And this came up, sadly, in World War II and in the Holocaust, about when people escaped and fled, and when they stayed and tried to help the community that they were with, because you'd say, well, just because you have the right to escape, why are you escaping? So this is a complicated halakhic question. There's a halakhic element to it. So Shulchan Aruch seems to paske, and you got to be part of it. Magen Avraham says that's if you can help in some way, and probably most people can help in some way. And the Yom Shel Shlomo, the Maharshal, who's a little bit after the Shulchan Aruch, or right around the time of the Shulchan Aruch, he has a comment in Bava Kamma that when it talks about a dever by air, when there's plague or pestilence in a city, so the question is, are you supposed to stay in the city and try to help, or are you supposed to leave? So in terms of leaving, there's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says, "Yotzim min ha'ir v'yitalon l'shol shalal." When that was at the time of the first place to make this, when Yirmiyahu said, "Whoever leaves and surrenders and shows that they're not trying to stand against Hashem's command that they surrendered, so they'll save their soul." But it's true in lots of other situations, and so too in Amos when he threatens drought. Hashem says, that Namos says in the name of Hashem, I'll bring rain on one city and another city I won't. So there's no particular reason necessarily you have to stay and live in the city that Hashem is punishing if you can leave. But, says the Maharshal, if you have some way to help people, and that's where the Magen Avraham was getting it, then God forbid that you just decide to leave because it's easier for you to leave. And then you're being a poresh min hatzibur, and you won't see their comfort. Here, by the way, it says you won't see not only their comfort, you won't see Nechamat Zion, the comfort of Zion in general. But if he himself can't do anything, so that's a Gemara in Shabbos, elsewhere, Shabbos, Lamed Bin Amarav, says, Al Yamor Adam, Makom Sakana, the place of danger. What are you doing? Putting yourself in danger. So that split is the Tzvez is pointing out that would seem to be a split that we have, that if somebody finds themselves in a situation of danger, or there's this danger coming to a community, then the individual has the responsibility to help to the extent that the individual can. If he has no way to help, or she has no way to help, then you're allowed to run away. You don't have to put yourself into danger. But if you have the ability to help in a meaningful way, then it would seem that you're required to. And then he says, but I also went on in this other place, but he's saying enough of it here that we can benefit from it. We can move on to the rest of the tshuva. But he says, in the essential halacha of whether or not you have to put yourself in situation of debt, he said, he thinks that he found Gemara's, not this story in Nida, but other Gemara's in the Babli, Yerushalmi, in the Midrash Halacha, and in halachic works, that there is no obligation to put yourself into a suffix sakana to save somebody else from a vada sakana. And it says, and he thinks there's a good chance that you might not be allowed to. Prat bizdei milchama, other than war. Right, going to war is certainly a requirement, as I explained in Tzitzit Eliezer, an earlier response from Tzitzit Eliezer, because going to war is a whole different thing, because war is essentially dangerous, and when a community goes to war and a nation goes to war, everybody has to be part of it. But I just want to backtrack for a second, although I'm not a posek in any way whatsoever, but I do think it's an interesting claim to say, when the Tzitzit says he thinks that you might not be allowed to put yourself into a possible situation of danger to save somebody else. I think here the question of the odds as we best understand them become important ones, meaning every time somebody steps into the water to swim, there's some danger there, especially if it's at a beach, right? There's always some danger there. We don't think of it as dangerous. It's the kind of activity that one is allowed to do. So let's suppose that somebody, God forbid, is out there in the water, 30 feet out from shore, which is a fine amount of time, and they start having some kind of distress, a heart attack, whatever it is, or stomach cramps. I knew a guy years ago, sadly, who drowned in 3 feet of water because he had stomach cramps. He couldn't get out of the water, and he was just doubled over in pain, and he drowned to death. And it was a terrible tragedy. So now, if I'm standing on the shore, right, for me to run out, and I'm no lifeguard, I'm not particularly trained in this, but it's 25 feet out the shore, 30 feet shore, I swim out there all the time, and I swim back all the time. If I had to swim out there and just drag the person in, and so they don't drown out there, is that a question of safek sakana? It's in some sense a doubtful danger, but that's an interesting question. I think it comes up, the example I gave at the beginning of the talk, this shiur was a question of donating kidneys. So there was a time, I think there's an early shiur of Moshe Feinstein where he says it's not allowed. There was a time when donating a kidney was a relatively dangerous kind of a thing. It was actual real safek sakana, meaning safek sakana would be, let's say, if there's a 50-50 chance somebody's going to die for doing this. So there is the kind of thing where I think they're saying, I'm not sure, it seems to me that you're not allowed to put yourself in that kind of danger, even to save somebody else from a danger. So you say, my kidney will almost definitely help that person, but it's a 50-50 chance that I'm going to die. Now, 50-50 chance, you got to remember, it doesn't mean like, yes, you will die, or no, you won't die. It means that we do this procedure, and 50% of the donors die. That's 50-50. So it's almost never that much. And then the question becomes a question of the percentages of what we define as a safek sakana. What's considered a doubtful danger that you're putting yourself into? So if we know that people who swim out 25 feet out to shore and pull unconscious people in almost never drown themselves. They drown themselves one in a million times. I think that might not even be a case of safek sakana, of doubtful danger. That's not what he's talking about. I think what he's talking about is real doubtful danger. I mean, you go to war, there's a real chance you're going to die. So I think that's what he's talking about. In any case, bring that back to the story with Rabbi Tarfon that we started with. So he think, right, and that the Rabbi Tarfon story is about doubtful danger and what he's doing or not doing. So he says he thinks that gives you a solution to another problem that people bring up that people don't always talk about, that he thinks is also relevant here. He says, first, let's notice something problematic in the story itself. They come to Rabbi Tarfon, and Rabbi Tarfon says, go hide yourselves. Because if I don't hide you, he says to them, if I don't hide you, they're going to find you. So we know that already. It's an odd thing for Rabbi Tarfon to say. He says, what's he talking to them about? That's why they came to him and said, please hide us, because they knew that. And then when he says, I'm not going to hide you because I think there's enough evidence that you might have done it that I'm not required to hide you, he says, go hide yourselves. That's also weird. What? They didn't know that they should try to find hiding place. They thought he had a better hiding place for them. But of course, if he says no, they're going to go hide themselves. So what is it that he was saying to them? So to get to the answer to that question, he brings up the problem that we started with, and he brings it up because the Chazon Ish brought up the question. The Chazon Ish and Sanhedrin, who wanted to figure out the following problem. Let's say somehow I see an arrow shot by somebody, and it's about to kill a group of people. So, in arrow terms, I think it's hard to know. But let's suppose, you know, somebody shoots, and when it comes to shooting, it goes so fast, I'm not sure how you're going to be able to turn it away. But the case is, I see somebody shoots an arrow at a bunch of people, and he's going to kill a bunch of people. Usually arrows don't do that. Today, I think a good example would be a grenade. So, he throws a grenade into a group of people, and I can flip it away. Now, our usual classic example of the grenade situation would be where one person would jump on the grenade and sacrifice their lives to save the group. We're going to get to that in a second. But the case that Chazon Ish was worried about was you couldn't do that. You don't know how to do that. It's not a possibility. But you can turn the path of the grenade or arrow aside such that we'll kill only one person, right? So let's say the grenade, I guess the example would be the grenade's going by me. The person who throws it's going by me in a way that I can't catch it and hold it, but I can tip it. If I tip it, the only place I can tip it to is the place where it's going to kill one person. That's the question. Am I allowed to take an action that will kill one person, but that's instead of the almost definite death, as far as we can tell, of a group of people. Now, the Chazon Ish says, originally, he thinks that, yeah, you're required to. So, the problem is that we have a sugya in the Gemara that talks about when, let's say, an enemy comes up to a group of people and says, give us one of you to kill or we'll kill all of you. The halacha is you're not allowed to give over one of the people because you're choosing to kill somebody. We're not allowed to choose to kill somebody to give over somebody to be killed instead of the whole group being killed. We have to just also, you're not allowed to make that choice. So Chazon Ish's instinct originally was, but deflecting the arrow, or in my case, the grenade, which I think just works better as a case. Deflecting the grenade is at the moment of deflection, not an action of killing, it's an action of saving. And therefore, I should be allowed to save this group of people by deflecting it. The fact that after I deflect it, it will go somewhere else and kill somebody else, that he originally suggested was a completely separate thing. Now, I have to say, he's going to change his mind, so I don't feel uncomfortable suggesting that there's a flaw in the logic there, because the case in the Gemara was give us over one person. There too, you could say, well, the giving over is just saving the whole group, and the fact that later on these non-Jews will kill that person, that's not our worries. I think that's a complicated claim to make. But then Chazon Ish himself retreats from that position. He says, but when I'm turning the arrow, when you deflect the grenade, you're actively killing somebody in that, basically in that moment, right? The grenade, there's a 3-second delay, let's say, between pulling the pin and it going off. So at second one, it goes by me, or second one and a half, it goes by me. I deflect it out of the path of the group of people. A second later, it's going to kill somebody. That's all part of the actual, whereas in the Masira case, as I just said a second ago, in handing it over, there's no action of killing them. That's because we are pretty confident the non-Jews will do what they'll do, and therefore you can't do that, and therefore it should be all the more so that you can't kill somebody by deflecting an arrow or a grenade. So, the problem is, there's a case in the Tanakh where Sheva ben Bichri goes to hide, and Yoav comes to the town, and the Isha HaTikoit, the wise woman of Tekoa, finds a way to give over Sheva ben Bichri, and they kill Sheva ben Bichri, and then they hand them over to Yoav to save the whole group. So doesn't that sound like you're actively killing somebody to save a whole group? The problem, the difference is there. Sheva ben Bichri was himself already liable for the death penalty, for capital punishment, so therefore you were allowed to do it. So it gets complicated, all the factors you have to bring in to play. Are you allowed to save in the saving of the one, in the saving of the group, what are you actually doing? So if in the saving of the group you're giving over somebody to death, that seems not allowed. If you're actively killing somebody, that also seems not allowed, although even though at the moment you're not doing it, so therefore he leaves it as a tsarich iyun. Chazon Ish leaves it as, I'm not sure. I find it difficult to rule on this question. I'm not sure what you can do. Now comes to this and he says, I think I can prove that you're required to deflect the arrow or the grenade, and if not required, at least permitted to, because in Choshen Mishpat there's a Ramah. So this is not going to be his final answer. We're going to see why it's not his final answer, but this is what he's thinking. The Ramah says, let's suppose I see something coming, some kind of a damage, monetary damage we're talking about, and that's going to be the crucial difference by the time the end of the story. Let's say a monetary damage is coming upon me. I'm allowed to save myself from it, even if my saving myself will cause damage to somebody else. So a case would be, let's say, for example, I see a dam breaks, and therefore a flood is about to wash out my field and my crop, but I have some way of diverting the water. And when I divert the water, I'll save my field. Now, once I divert the water, it'll go into somebody else's field and destroy their field. So now I'm allowed to do that because the action that I'm doing is not damaging their field. The action I'm doing is saving my own field. So that seems like there. Obviously, I'm allowed to save myself from damage. A person is allowed to save themselves from damage, even though that's going to cause other damage to somebody else. Now, you might say, well, that's because the person themselves. So maybe if the arrow is coming at me and I'm part of a group, or the grenade is coming at us as part of a group, we would be allowed to throw it towards somebody else, but maybe not a third party, because that's not a relevant consideration. It says to the Ezra, because no, to be Yehuda, in a response, had written that it's true about other people as well, that other people, let's say, so again, the dam breaks, and that's the example that the Ezra is referring to, and the Ramah is referring to. The dam breaks, I see a way to divert the water. The dam breaks, it's going to, you know, and it's going to wash out Jack's field, and I'm standing right there, and I like Jack very much, and I know of a way to divert the water. I'm allowed to divert the water, even if I don't think of it at the moment, whether or not I think of it at the moment, even that's going to end up washing out somebody else's field. Since I am feeling about Jack and concerned for Jack, I'm allowed to do that. That's another beauty that said as well. It's not restricted to the person who's about to bear the financial damage. It's anybody's allowed to do that. So it says, yeah, but there's the difference. Now you think about it for a second, you realize there's a big difference between monetary damage, which is bad, but it's not the same thing as death damage. And with death damage, we have no evidence that you're allowed to do that. And in the case of death damage, there's no obvious permissibility of taking action that will lead to somebody's death, even though it's leading to one person's death, and in doing so, it's saving a lot of people. We have no evidence that we're allowed to do that. We generally assume shev al ta'aseh is adif. It's better to not do anything rather than do something, because it comes into this long-standing halakhic principle of, it's in the Gemara, of my chazi didama didach sumak. How do you know that your blood is redder? How do you know that anybody's blood is redder? And therefore, we can't make these kinds of judgments. It's not like their blood might be redder, their blood be redder, and if we only knew, it's that we don't make these kinds of judgments. And when it comes to killing, actually, it says, and don't think that one versus the many could be an issue as well. Again, that's the kind of a choice, the kind of a decision that we assume we're not allowed to make. And therefore, when it comes to, let's say, the grenade is about to hit five people, I'm going to push it aside and kill one person. It's a choice I'm not allowed to make, not because it's a choice I'm not allowed to make, because for all I know, that one person is in some way more valuable to Hashem than the five. It's not that I'm allowed to assume they are, because I'm not allowed to. I couldn't do it the other way either, right? You know, let's say that one person is, you know, whoever you think of as the greatest righteous person in the world, right? The greatest gadol b'Torah, and somebody mamish gadol b'Torah, and we're not arguing that point here. And the grenade's going towards them, and I say, oh, I'll push it on the five people, because those five people there, who knows what they are? As long as they're not all liable for the death penalty, right? If they were all legitimately and well known to be liable for the death penalty, there seems to be some evidence that maybe I could do that. But if they're, unless we know that for sure, it seems like for sure, and you can't. So that's the issue. But there is an exception to this, because there's a case in Ta'anit, and Yudchet, there's a Rashi in Ta'anit on the 18b. Ta'anit 18b, two people named Lulianus and Papus. And they refer to it in the Ta'anit, and Rashi explains to us who they were. They were great righteous people. And then there's a whole discussion of what their righteousness was. And one of the examples Rashi gives is that the king's daughter was once found murdered. And people told the king the Jews did it. It's not clear that it was true. They told the king the Jews did it, and the king said, fine, all the Jews are to be wiped out, or all the Jews to be expelled, whatever it was. Some terrible tragedy was probably wiped out. Right? So Lulianus and Papos said, you know what, it was us. We killed her, and the king killed them. So how can they do that? So the answer is, since the answer says, they were also in danger of death anyway. So in situations where one is in danger, when oneself is in danger of death, in significant danger of death, there one is allowed to sacrifice one's life in order to save other people. Another possibility that he adds is that it might even be that the individual in question doesn't have to be in actual danger of his life on his own, but that in order to save a group of people, that in fact maybe you are allowed to put your life in danger because you're allowed to save the community. Because in general, we assume that you're not allowed to do it, you're not allowed to make that decision about other people, but that one is allowed to sacrifice oneself to save an entire community. So the example of jumping on a grenade, are you allowed to jump on a grenade to save a group? Let's say you're standing far enough away that maybe you'd be injured by the grenade and about killed by it. But you have just enough time to run and jump on the grenade. I'm not saying you're required to, but you are allowed to, because when it comes to one's own life, in terms of saving communities, there we do assume that one is allowed to to give over one's life in those situations to save the entire community. And then he quotes Rabbi Yonah in the commentary to Bava Batra of Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah, who quotes Sanhedrin, and says this idea, that when it comes to making decisions about who to save and who not to save, our general principle is we don't make such decisions, and Sheva Al Ta'aseh is the principle we should have. Now, I should say, in the world at large, people don't always understand this principle of Sheva Al Ta'aseh, that sometimes it's better to refrain from action. They think that refraining from action is exactly as bad as taking a problematic action, and I think it's just halakhically untrue, and it's a principle to realize that sometimes we unrecognize our inability to contribute to a situation, and therefore we just have to watch it unfold, and we cannot make any contribution to improving the situation, and any choice we would make would be a choice that's illegitimate on our part to allow ourselves to make. Then he wants to give examples where this is true. We've had some examples like war and grenades and things like that, but he gives another example. He gives an example about a car case that I can't get into now because I'm running out of time and I think it doesn't quite work, but another example would be in terms of let's say you have people in the hospital who are deathly ill, and you have some people who are not deathly ill, and you're triaging things, and you're going to take medical equipment from one to the other, and how you do it, how you don't do it, that will be situations of who are you allowed to put and not put into danger for the saving of other people. Now all of that, halakhically interesting, and comes up in an actual halakhic situation where we have to think about how we are and aren't allowed to act, and when we have to just throw up our hands and recognize that we're not allowed to act in certain ways, even though that would be a way that would save lives, because it would damage and hurt or kill other people. He says that also explains Rabbi Tarfon's story that we had. Rabbi Tarfon was telling the guys here, look, I don't know if you've killed them or not. I think there's enough room for me to think that you might have killed them. And it's true that if you stay out in the open, they're going to catch you and kill you, and I am not supposed to be contributing to that. That's as if I'm giving you over yourselves. But to require me, Rabbi Tarfon, to hide you, that's requiring me to put myself into danger, and I'm not sure that I am required to actively put myself into danger to save you because you might be murderers. But if you go hide yourselves, well, at that point, the calculus will switch, because then for me to do something, I'll have to actively do something to give you over, and that too I'm not allowed to do. So the principle of Sheva Al Ta'aseh, refraining from action, will come into play. So basically, the Tzitzit Ezra is telling us that the story in Nida that came up every time for hiding these possible murderers brings up all sorts of issues of putting ourselves in danger to save others, and what we are and aren't allowed to do in terms of actively killing, actively saving, or refraining from action. And that in the case of those possible murders, the Rabbi Tarfon story, he was saying there's enough evidence that I'm not allowed to actively save you because that puts myself in danger, and I'm not allowed to actively put myself in danger given who you are and who you've come to be. But to the extent that you hide yourselves, I will be unable, halachically, I will be unable to turn you over as well, because that too would be taking action in a way that I'm not to do, and therefore that you do. So the distinction for the trolley problem between taking action and not taking action was the main thrust of what Stiller said. It may be that to save a community, an individual is allowed to take action about their own lives, but other than that, very, very often the principle is that in hard situations where taking action would involve us pretending to know and understand moral calculuses that we don't really understand, that's where very often our answer is Sheva Al Ta'aseh Adif. It's better to do nothing and to let the situation unfold, because we know that we're not expert enough to know how we should be interacting with the situation. And that is a response of the day for the second day of Kislev. Have a great day.